Thank you for joining me for today's Beast Watch News Update. News from the Internet's most comprehensive Bible prophecy news website, BeastWatchNews.com. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown. This is the last part, part four of this series. Hebrew roots and Christian believers in Yeshua/Jesus are in the crosshairs of Jewish religious anti-missionaries to convert as many to Judaism or Noahidism as possible. That is why I have produced this series. The first line of attack is Yeshua's deity. And the attack doesn't come from Buddhists or Native Americans, the Maasai of Kenya, the Aboriginals of Australia, or even Russia. The attack on Yeshua that began in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago is the same one that continues to this day. And it is spearheaded by a Jewish agenda whose lies need to be exposed to prevent people from falling into the trap and losing their souls. Before I start, let me begin by saying we have to distinguish between Jews and Jews, as it were, to know who were the defiant ones that turned Yeshua over to the Romans and who will turn today's believers over to other authorities. There is a difference between Jerusalem's religious Jews and cultural Jews in the Bible, and it is the same today. The religious Jews are those that occupy Jerusalem and govern from there. Cultural Jews were everyone else in Judea, Samaria, and Galilee, the common person who just wanted to live a life. Jews lived all over the known world, but those form only a small part of the Bible's narrative in both the Tanakh and the New Testament. Read the prophets. Who did they address as the troublemakers who were leading the entire house of Judah astray? The Jews in Jerusalem, the leaders. The prophets, Yeshua, and the apostles spoke against Jerusalem's religious Jews. These are the leaders that fight against Yahweh's kingdom by reinterpreting His words to create a religion. A religion is nothing more than a cult following, no matter how big it is. The earth is divided between the three monotheistic religions, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. Each of these is a cult. They point people away from the kingdom to religion. Their followers are sincere, believing the doctrines that they are being taught, but Yeshua told the disciples to beware of the false doctrines of the Pharisees. We must not foster hatred of all Jews because some of them are crooks, liars, and thieves who want to kill us for our faith in Yeshua. No one in his right mind wants to throw an entire family into prison for the crimes of one family member. Let us remember that Yahweh has a remnant that is His in each tribe: Judah, Benjamin, Simeon, and Levi from the house of Judah, and those tribes from the house of Israel. Let us also remember that the two houses are, by now, totally genetically mixed. There are many from the northern tribes that have converted to Judaism in the last 2,700 years since their expulsion from the land, and many from the southern tribes have converted to Christianity in the last 2,000 years. So let us keep our hearts and minds straight to realize that the problem Jews who are about to unleash the Antichrist on the world are Jerusalem's religious leading Jews and not the cultural Jews, just as it was during the time of the writings, the prophets, Yeshua, and the apostles. This struggle between believers in Yeshua and non-believers will end with a great tribulation triggered by the arrival of a Jewish Messiah claiming to be God. In this section, we will examine the truth of the Council of Nicaea that is used by Jewish religious anti-missionaries against believers in Yeshua. Also, Jewish claims that Yeshua does not exist in history through what is called the argument from silence. We will look at the ossuary of James, a physical, archaeological proof of Yeshua's existence. And finally, I will reveal the Jewish Antichrist that was published in a Jewish website a couple of weeks ago. Christians are caught in the doctrine that the Antichrist will come from Rome. Nowhere in the Gospels or New Testament writings are the Romans mentioned as an enemy of Yeshua. Romans later became enemies of Yeshua. Rome was not the main focus of Yeshua's ministry or his future prophecies. His ministry was for the house of Judah and the house of Israel. Everything that the occupier, Rome, did was by Yahweh's hand to chastise the Jews so they would repent. It wasn't the Romans who seized Yeshua to kill him, but Jerusalem's religious Jews. So we need to get our focus in the right place, because the book of Revelation is about Jerusalem, not Rome. The antimony was between those Judeans, Samaritans, and Galileans who believed Yeshua is the divine Messiah, and the religious leaders of Jerusalem who rejected him, not between believers in Yeshua and Rome. Thus, the Antichrist will not be Roman, even though Romans persecuted Christians later on. He will be from the same religious Jewish enclave that existed then and that still exists today. The game is the same now. Only the names and faces have changed, and the religious Jews of today have the same agenda as back then, to establish all Israel with only the house of Judah. To include the lost tribes, they need to convert believers in Yeshua to Judaism. And to accomplish that, they need to convince believers that Yeshua did not exist. So, religious Jews deny the historicity of Yeshua. And one way modern religious Jews destroy faith in Yeshua is by lying about the purpose of the Council of Nicaea. Here's the truth about the Council of Nicaea. Yeshua is a real historical figure written about by ancient historians, something that the modern religious Jews refute. He is not fiction, not made up by the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD to create a religion with the aim of making him into a deity. The idea that the Council of Nicaea is the start of making people believe Yeshua is God is all over the internet and in Jewish anti-missionary materials everywhere. Many believers get caught in this particular Jewish trap. The purpose of the Council of Nicaea was to create a doctrinal separation between Christians and Jews. It was not for the purpose of voting whether or not Yeshua is God in the flesh. Among the Christians that attended the council were those who denied Yeshua's divinity, just as there still are those who deny it in Christian churches today. His divinity was one of many issues to define the doctrines of the church. By the time of Nicaea, there were three variations of religion regarding Yahweh Elohim. The slow split from the first century had widened the breach between religious Jews who rejected Yeshua and Jews and Gentiles who accepted him. This problem is recorded in the apostles' writings. Paul particularly warned the Jews to stop proselytizing the new Gentile converts. Acts 15 had to do with Pharisaic believers who wanted to circumcise the Gentiles. Circumcision had become a euphemism for conversion to Judaism. The Jerusalem Council, under the leadership of James, rejected the idea that Gentiles should be converted to Judaism via circumcision. Salvation does not come through Judaism, was the point. The apostles fought Jewish religious leaders until their deaths. Judaism's doctrine that Yeshua is not God crept into first century Christianity under the guise of men like Marcion and movements like the Ebionites, who taught that Yeshua was not divine. During this time period, all were keeping some amount of the simple commandments of the Torah, the Sabbath, food laws, etc. Those who believed Yeshua had come as Messiah, but that he is not God, caused a breach within the believers who became known as Christians, i.e., Messianics. Religious Jews continued proselytizing Christians to Judaism. The Jewish proselytizing of the last few decades, with the independent formation of the Hebrew Roots movement, is nothing new. Christian bishops were fighting back against the factions that were splitting believers. Thus, the Council of Nicaea was their effort to formalize doctrine by which believers could be included or excluded as Christian. Yeshua's deity was only one of the issues that was raised. The council's debates involved the creation of Easter as different and exclusive from Passover, Christian believers being prohibited from attending synagogues as had been done by all believers from the time of the apostolic writings, the formalization of the Trinity doctrine, decreeing the proper method of consecrating bishops, condemning lending money at interest by clerics and denying bishops, priests, and deacons moving from one church to another without approval from Rome. It also confirmed the primacy of Alexandria and Jerusalem over other congregations. The council intended to make a canon enforcing celibacy of the clergy, but failed to do so at that time. As you can see, the Council of Nicaea was not convened for the sole purpose of electing Yeshua as God. This, though, is the lie taught by religious Jews seeking to convert Christians and Hebrew Roots believers to Judaism today. The principle used by religious Jews to claim that Yeshua was not considered divine until such time as his divinity became part of written doctrine from the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD can be used against them. If something is nothing until it is written down is now a principle, then we can call into question the veracity of the Jewish oral law. It wasn't until the 2nd century A.D. that the oral law was written down. Using the same principles, Jews cannot now make the claim that Moses came from Mount Sinai with an oral law. The situation that spurred the codification of the Jewish oral law was the Roman dispersion of 70 A.D. For fear that the oral traditions would be lost, Judah Hanasi began codifying the oral law sometime in the mid-2nd century. Its codification was completed early in the 3rd century A.D. Using the current religious Jewish understanding that doctrine does not become doctrine until it is written down and formalized, we can confidently claim that the oral law is as made up from the 3rd century and forward as is the doctrines that came from the Council of Nicaea. The divinity of Yeshua was not the reason for the Christian fathers meeting to discuss doctrine, The divinity of Yeshua was not the reason for the Christian fathers meeting to discuss doctrine. The divinity of Yeshua was at issue from the first century with the Marcionites and Ebionites from the first century, who denied his divinity while other Christians upheld it. The apostles, in the second half of the first century, wrote about those who were coming into the congregations with their false doctrines, one of which is that Yeshua is not God, and which is why the apostles wrote about Yeshua being God in the flesh. It was their testimony that true belief in Yeshua included that he is God, and they commanded believers to not even talk to those that denied it. 2 John 1, verses 7 through 11. For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Yeshua HaMashiach is come in the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourselves that we lose not those things which we have wrought, but that we receive a full reward. Whosoever transgresses and abides not in the doctrine of Christ has not God. He that abides in the doctrine of Christ, he has both the Father and the Son. If there come any to you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. For he that bids him Godspeed is partaker of his evil deeds. Don't believe the religious anti-missionary Jews who say the Council of Nicaea is where the divinity of Yeshua was agreed to. It simply was made a formalized doctrine of Christianity, one of the many doctrines formalized at that meeting in 325 AD. Now, let's talk about Yeshua in history. Another weapon formed against Yeshua by the religious Jews is the claim that no historian ever wrote about him. They claim this creates an argument from silence, and the silence of ancient historians proves he never existed, according to them. They also claim that the historians that are traditionally viewed as having mentioned Yeshua did not write about him at all. They claim that Christians inserted historical references of their fictional Jesus to lend credence to the claim that the Messiah had already come to earth. Asher Norman, lawyer, anti-missionary, and author of 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, used a list of historians listed by John Remsburg in his book, The Christ, published in 1909. In his book, Asher Norman did not comment further on the Remsburg list of historians, but spent the bulk of chapter 23 detracting from the known historical sources who do mention Yeshua. These known historians are Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny the Younger. He conveniently left out references to Yeshua from the Talmud and the Church Fathers, who are regarded as historians, such as Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, and the New Testament epistles. Even though secular historians and archaeologists use the New Testament to validate new historical claims that come to light. Writing anything in ancient times was an expensive undertaking and not to be done frivolously. Subject matter was important. Years of study and knowledge of the subject matter was imperative. Ancient historians didn't just pick up a piece of paper and start writing about something they did not know about. Today, we don't understand what a job and expense it was to produce a written piece. One piece of papyrus could cost a normal person a day's wage. This is why most historians were either wealthy or had wealthy backing, and the wealthy don't like to throw their good money on bad projects. As you will see, Remsburg's list that Norman seized for his own anti-missionary purposes undermines the importance of the ancient writer's subject matter. After a study of the subject matter, it is possible to conclude that the Jews did not exist at that time, using the anti-missionary principle of argument from silence. I investigated every one of John Remsburg's list of 41 historians and found that the list included men who wrote about agriculture and other issues. Some were satirists and orators, even oratory teachers. Some were poets or military men writing about Rome's conquests. Some on the list were names of men who shared the same name as others, such as Apollonius and Hermogenes Silius Italicus. There are 50 Apolloniuses, for instance. Which Apollonius was Remsburg referring to? Hermogenes is a name that is shared by at least 5 other historical figures with the same name. Which Hermogenes was Remsburg referring to? Did Asher Norman even take a look at that? As I said, the name Apollonius is shared with no less than 50 other Apolloniuses. Remsburg probably referred to Apollonius of Tyana, according to Wikipedia. Of the 50 Apolloniuses listed on Wikipedia, it appears that only 18 of those lived in the 1st through 3rd centuries, the time frame for writing about Yeshua, according to Remsburg and Norman. It is possible that the listing of Apollonius may also refer to one of these other historians as well. However, since neither Remsburg nor Norman are willing to give details about the historians they list, we will look at Wikipedia's most likely candidate as an example of how wicked it is to claim that no ancient historian ever wrote about Yeshua. Apollonius of Tyana was a Greek Neo-Pythagorean philosopher born into a wealthy family from the town of Tyana in the Roman province of Cappadocia in Anatolia. Most scholars agree that he was a contemporary of Jesus of Nazareth, which is why we are looking at this particular Apollonius. All that is known of him comes from his primary biographer, Philostratus the Elder, who lived from 170 to 247 AD, who places Apollonius at about 3 BC to 97 AD, the first century. But here is where Apollonius's inclusion in the argument from silence falls apart. Philostratus compared Apollonius of Tyana to Jesus of Nazareth. Rather than create an argument from silence to prove that Yeshua was not mentioned by other historians, Apollonius of Tyana actually verifies the existence of Yeshua because he was compared to Yeshua by his biographer, Philostratus, who at the request of Empress Julia Domna claimed that Apollonius performed similar miracles to Yeshua's. It is unclear who Hermogenes Silius Italicus is from Remsburg's list. Either Remsburg made him up, or he combined historical names of more than one ancient historian, or this person does not exist. Yet, here he is on Remsburg's 1909 list and in Asher Norman's 26 Reasons book. There is no Hermogenes Silius Italicus. There is Hermogenes, and there is Silius Italicus, but no Hermogenes Silius Italicus. The fact is that none of the historians on the Remsburg list that Norman used wrote about Jerusalem, the temple, the Jews, or any of the famous Jews of that time. None of them mentioned Gamaliel, Caiaphas, or even Paul, who was a prolific writer, Roman citizen, and among secular scholars today is used as a historian of the time period. Modern Jews, though, reject the New Testament for its historical content because of their hatred of Yeshua. Some military historians mention Jerusalem in their accounts, but only as to Rome's glorious conquest of the place, men like Justus of Tiberius. Those ancient historians had no interest in the lives of the Jews or their politics. Almost none of them traveled to Jerusalem, thus they had no reason to write about anything in Jerusalem or any of its self-important people. What people fail to understand is that Jerusalem was viewed as a little burg, a backwater town, a boring place to live, too far from the importance of Rome. Being assigned to govern in Jerusalem, as Pilate was, would have been considered a demotion, not a promotion. It was like the American General Patton being removed from the limelight of Germany to his lowered place in Africa during World War II. The real action was at Normandy and other places in Europe, and everyone knew it. Even though the North African campaign was important, it wasn't the limelight, and neither was Jerusalem a limelight of Rome. One of the historians on Remsburg's list, as used by Asher Norman, was Marcus Velius Paterculus, who lived from 19 BC to AD 31. Paterculus authored an amateurish history of Rome, according to Britannica.com, that was published just before he died in 30 AD. 30 AD? How is Paterculus a credible witness for the argument from silence when Yeshua's ministry had not begun by the time Paterculus died? There is one ancient historian who was contemporary with Yeshua, who should have known about him and could have written about him, but who the Jews say did not. His name is Philo. Jewish anti-missionaries rely heavily on Philo's lack of writing about Yeshua as an argument from silence that proves Yeshua never existed. Let's see if their claim holds up. Philo Judaeus, from 20 BCE to 50 of the Common Era, was a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt. Philo used philosophical allegory to harmonize Jewish scripture with Greek philosophy. His method followed the practices of both Jewish exegesis and Stoic philosophy. His allegorical exegesis was important for some Christian church fathers, but he had very little reception history within rabbinic Judaism. It was Philo who wrote about the Logos. He said the Logos was the firstborn of God. Philo also wrote that the Logos of the living God is the bond of everything, holding all things together and binding all the parts, and prevents them from being dissolved and separated. The Greek word Logos is word in English. John 1 describes the word, the Logos, as that which holds all things together. More importantly, Philo and John knew each other, according to Sarah Mancini Lombardi and Paola Pontani, authors of studies on the ancient Aramean version of Philo's works. Philo is believed to have been acquainted with Peter and James and baptized into the Christian faith by John, according to this book. According to a document published by Stanford University, Philo's work does not form a well-organized corpus. During Philo's time, the work was larger than the corpus we now have. The relation of Philo to the Hebrew exegetical traditions of his time is an important and controversial question. One of the major paradoxes for his posterity is that his work was ignored by Jews and saved by Christians, some of whom thought he was himself a Christian. For a long time, Philo was read and explained mostly by Christian authors. If Philo was thought to have been a Christian, and even to have known the apostles John, James, and Peter, why then do anti-missionaries believe Philo never wrote about Yeshua? Most possibly, it is because of Philo's works that have been lost. It is known that he wrote about the Essenes and other sects of Judaism, But because of the lost texts, no one really knows whether or not Philo wrote about Yeshua and the new sect called the Way from the book of Acts. Most scholars blame the missing texts on the mishandling of them by Christians. This is despite that Christian's historical legacy of being the most methodical and best at preserving texts. In fact, it has been said that without the Christians and their pursuit of preserving every detail of their lives, the history of Rome itself would have been lost. Philo was a famous and influential Jew in both Alexandria and Judea. He lived in Alexandria, but would have come to Jerusalem and would likely have known many of the Jewish leaders. If Philo began to follow Yeshua and proclaim that Yeshua is the Messiah, is it possible that the Jews themselves later destroyed the works of Philo that mentioned Yeshua? Philo's Christian conversion certainly lends itself to this theory, and why they have so adamantly tried to disassociate Philo from Yeshua. We have only a few names of the influential Jewish leaders in Judea at the time of Yeshua, Gamaliel, Caiaphas, and so forth. None of them are on record as having converted to believing Yeshua is the Messiah. However, Philo might be a different story, and the reason the Jews have tried so hard to wipe the record of his conversion from history. They cannot wipe out his name, as they are wont to do with many Jews' names, including Yeshua's, because Philo's writings were already known abroad early on and were already being used in Christian circles as additional writings to the apostles. Perhaps it was that the only resort left to religious Jews would have been to destroy anything Philo may have said about Yeshua. It must also be noted that despite Philo being well known among the Alexandrian and Judean Jews, he was not mentioned at all by the apostles in the Gospels or their writings, although they gave the names of many people. Here are a few of the other historians on Remsburg's list that was copied and pasted by Asher Norman. I can't include them all because of time constraints. Lucius Flavius Arrian of Nisomedia lived from about 86 or 89 A.D. until about 146 or 160 A.D. He was a Greek historian, public servant, military commander, and philosopher of the Roman period. The Anabasis of Alexander by Arrian is considered the best source on the campaigns of Alexander the Great. Arrian had no interest in Jerusalem, Gamaliel, Caiaphas, the temple at Jerusalem, or Yeshua or his fathers. His subject matter was Alexander the Great. Diochrysostom, also known as Dion Prusaeus. He was an orator of the second half of the first century into the first part of the second century. He wrote on literature, philosophy, and politics. He was considered as one of the most eminent of the Greek rhetoricians and sophists by the ancients who wrote about him. Rhetoricians practice and teach the art of persuasion. A sophist is a teacher of philosophy. Judaism was not part of Roman philosophy, so Yeshua Jesus's teachings were not his subject, nor were the problems in Jerusalem at any time his subject matter. But here is another problem with Remsburg's list that Asher Norman copied and pasted into his book to prove Yeshua didn't exist. Diochrysostom and Dion Prusaeus are the same man, yet they are listed separately in Remsburg's list and in Asher Norman's book of lies about Yeshua. Feverinus of Arelate, from A.D. 80 to 160 A.D., was an intersex Roman sophist and academic skeptic philosopher who flourished during the reign of Hadrian and the Second Sophistic. He never traveled to Jerusalem or wrote about the city, nor did he ever mention the Jews. If a writer doesn't mention the place or the people, he is not about to mention one person out of context, because context is everything when writing about someone. Now we come to Justus of Tiberius. He was born and lived in the second half of the first century AD in Tiberias, Israel. His subject matter was the Roman conquest of Jerusalem. That is his only mention of God's city. It appears that Justus was a Romanized Jew with no interest in the God of his fathers, Jerusalem, the temple, which was probably gone by the time he was born, or fairly close to being gone. It has been said that since Justus was a Jew living in the land in the first century, his silence about Yeshua proves Yeshua did not exist. That must mean also that none of the Jews of that time existed either, since Justus never mentions those that the Jews think are important, such as Onkelos, who was born in 35 AD and who wrote the Onkelos Targum, Rabbi Akiva, who was born in 50 AD and died in 138 AD, Gamaliel II, who was the first person to lead the Sanhedrin as Nasi after the fall of the Second Temple in 70 CE. Gamaliel was appointed Nasi approximately 10 years later. All these men were contemporaries of Justus. Why didn't he write about them? Perhaps they didn't exist. Little else is known about Justus's life except what is told by his political and literary enemy, Josephus Flavius. Juvenal, or Decimus Lunius Juvenalis, wrote of satires. He is known chiefly for his 16 satires, which contain a vivid representation of life in Rome under the empire. Satirists were the political comedians of their day. These uniquely biting juvenile satires were probably written in the years between AD 100 and AD 128 about the Roman standards he powerfully denounced. Jerusalem, Israel, the temple, Jews, were not even a subject for historians by then, let alone a comedian. Lysias. Who? There was someone who lived with that name, but it was from 445 BC to 380 BC. Now there's a good reason he didn't talk about Yeshua / Jesus. Martial. Marcus Valerius Martialis, known in English as Martial, lived between 38 or 41 AD and died between 102 and 104 AD. He was a Roman poet from Hispania, modern Spain, best known for his 12 books of epigrams published in Rome between AD 86 and 103 during the reigns of the emperors Domitian, Nerva, and Trajan. Martial was interested in Roman conquests and emperors, not Jews, Jerusalem, the temple that had been destroyed, or Judaism. Therefore, why would he mention Yeshua? Pliny the Elder lived from 23 AD to 79 AD. He wrote on the subject of natural history. He spent most of his spare time studying, writing, and investigating natural and geographic phenomena in the field. He would have no reason to refer to Yeshua / Jesus, even though our Savior is a natural and supernatural wonder. Marcus Fabius Quintilianus lived from about 35 AD to 100 AD. He was a Roman educator and rhetorician from Hispania, widely referred to in medieval schools of rhetoric and in Renaissance writing. The only extant work of Quintilian is a 12-volume textbook on rhetoric entitled Institutio Oratorio, generally referred to in English as the Institutes of Oratory, published around A.D. 95. In other words, he taught public speaking and persuasion. Was Jerusalem, the temple, and the Jews of his day, because he was a contemporary of that time, his subject matter? No. Did he even know or care about the politics of Jerusalem during the time of Yeshua, from where he lived in Spain? Probably not. Gaius Valerius Flaccus lived during the same time as Yeshua, but he was a Roman poet who wrote the Argonautica, a poem done in the style of the fictional poem about Jason and the Argonauts, which was dedicated to Vespasian on his setting out for Britain. It was written during the siege or shortly after the capture of Jerusalem by Titus in 70 AD. Valerius's poetry was about glorious Rome finally putting those pesky Jews in their place, not discussing their internal politics. Valerius Maximus was a contemporary of Yeshua whose family was poor and undistinguished, who owed everything to Sextus Pompeius, consul and proconsul of Asia, whom he accompanied to the east in 27. Valerius wrote anecdotes, was away from the Roman Empire by 27 AD, and was more interested in the imperial family of Germany. Was Jerusalem, the temple, the Jewish leaders of the day, their politics, or lives of common Jews throughout Judea, Samaria, or Galilee of interest to him? Were these his subject matter? No. But according to Jewish anti-missionary standards and the principle that no mention means no existence, we can safely assume now that no Jews existed in Valerius Maximus's day. These are only a few of the silly examples of the anti-missionaries' argument from silence. They argue themselves out of existence. The anti-missionaries discount Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny the Younger, who all mention Yeshua in their writings, because their subject matter was the Jews, Jerusalem, and the temple. Anti-missionaries' accusations is against Christians who they say added references about Yeshua to those works. Other scholarly Jews, such as Herschel Shanks of the Biblical Archaeology Society and many other scholars, both religious and secular, disagree. The controversies created by Jewish accusations regarding these writings is too much for this short paper. However, let me also add that because the religious Jewish anti-missionaries claim Christians defrauded the histories of Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny the Younger, that proves Christians entirely invented the New Testament. The fact is that Remsburg's list has many problems, and Asher Norman's disingenuous use of it is amateurish, given that he is a lawyer who should have checked the facts before publishing the list that now makes him appear stupid. The additional problem is that most people who read such nonsense do not themselves check the claims made by Jewish anti-missionaries. Now, let's look at Yeshua in the Talmud. The Talmud is itself a source of historic validation of the life of Yeshua. The paper, Jesus of Nazareth's Trial in the Uncensored Talmud by David Instone Brewer, is eye-opening. The name Yeshua appears throughout the Bavli and Yerushalmi Talmuds, but the Jews say these are not a reference to the Yeshua, but to various individuals named Yeshua or Joshua. However, another Talmud, the Munich Talmud, is the focus of David Instone Brewer's treatise. The paper's description says the Munich Talmud manuscript of Sanhedrin 43a preserves passages censored out of the printed editions, including the controversial trial of Yeshu Notzri. Chronological analysis of the layers in this tradition suggests that the oldest words are, "On the eve of Passover, they hung Jesus of Nazareth for sorcery and leading Israel astray." This paper argues that other words were added to this tradition in order to overcome three difficulties: a trial date during a festival, the unbiblical method of execution, and the charge of sorcery. So now it appears that the Jews themselves are guilty of the thing they accused Christians of doing, changing the ancient texts. The Talmud mentions Yeshua in many places, especially in the Tractate Sanhedrin. It teaches that Yeshua was illegitimate, conceived during menstruation. He had the soul of Esau, was a fool, a conjurer, a seducer, that he was crucified, buried in hell, and set up as an idol ever since by his followers. Jewish religious anti-missionaries protest too much when it comes to proving that Yeshua is not a historical figure, for if he wasn't, there would be no need to say so. The fact that evidence of his existence thrives in the lives of believers after 2,000 years proves something all by itself. That anti-missionaries have a need to destroy the New Testament, despite its proven historical accuracy, shows the evil and wickedness that underpins their activities. The ossuary of James is next. It has an inscription that reads, "James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus." It's a limestone box inscribed, "James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus," and is the most famous ancient artifact alleged to be a forgery. Its controversy also became known as the forgery trial of the century in Israel, as the IAA, the Israel Antiquities Authority, did everything in its power to prove the box and the inscription, especially the inscription, were forged. Five men were charged with various antiquities crimes, including forgery. Of the five defendants originally indicted in 2004, only two remained in the case: Oded Golan, an antiquities collector with one of the most important collections in Israel, and he was found guilty later on of the minor charge of trading in antiquities without a license; and Robert Deutsch, the most prominent antiquities dealer in Israel, who has also taught at Haifa University, served as a square supervisor at the archaeological excavation of Megiddo, and written scholarly books on his own and with other scholars of international repute. The inscription has been authenticated by two of the greatest world authorities on the paleography of this period, André Lemaire of the Sorbonne and Ada Yardeni of the Hebrew University. After a trial of more than 5 years, with 138 witnesses, more than 400 exhibits, and a trial transcript of 12,000 pages, Judge Aharon Farkash of the Jerusalem District Court has cleared the defendants in the forgery trial of the century of all forgery charges. His opinion in the case, handed down on March 14, 2012, is 474 pages long. The BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review, editor Herschel Shanks has argued for years that the allegations of forgery against Golan and Deutsch are not backed by sufficient evidence. Despite being Jewish, Shanks has stuck with his opinion. The Israel Antiquities Authority has failed to offer any report explaining why it concluded the ossuary is a forgery. Not only that, the IAA is now keeping the ossuary under lock and key to prevent more scientists and scholars from further study. The reason behind the IAA's objection is obvious. Any historical reference to Yeshua as Messiah must be destroyed. Despite the widespread perception among the Jews that the inscription was forged, so far not a single epigrapher has disqualified the ossuary inscription on paleographic grounds in legal testimony, that is, in the style of the writing and its integrity. In another BAR article on the trial over the question of forgery of the ossuary, Israel's leading paleographer, who testified, by the way, expert Ada Yardeni said, "If this is a forgery, I quit." The IAA is in collusion with the Jewish anti-missionaries, hoping to prevent people from knowing there is a history of the life of Yeshua. His history is not only found here, but with the historically accurate New Testament, Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius, and Pliny the Younger, and even the Talmud, though the anti-missionaries discount the veracity of these references to Yeshua. If the IAA and anti-missionaries can't debunk the evidence, they remove or reinterpret it. Now we're going to identify the trouble-making Jews. Jewish religious anti-missionaries trap believers with lies. As you have seen, both the Tanakh and the New Testament understand that God must come to save us because only He can. Thus, the Jews who wrote the New Testament knew that Yeshua had fulfilled the promise. But the Jews who rejected him created lies to destroy believers' faith so they can convert them to Judaism on behalf of their coming man, Messiah, who will die and never resurrect, and whose sons will succeed him as each of these dies. Jeremiah had something to say about these Jews long before they harassed Yeshua and his followers, even before they went into Babylonian captivity, where they learned even more wicked doctrines. He said the religious Jerusalem Jews were more treacherous than the house of Israel, in Jeremiah chapter 3, verses 6 to 11. The house of Israel, along with hundreds of thousands of Jews in the first century, accepted Yeshua as their Messiah, God in the flesh. The religious Jews did not, with perhaps the exception of some of the believing Pharisees of Acts 15. The general corpus of religious Jews embody the Antichrist spirit written of by the apostles. The Antichrist is not just opposite of Christ or Messiah. The Antichrist opposes Yahweh Elohim, the Creator. The Antichrist will declare himself to be God by doing the act of sitting on the throne in the temple built by the Jews on Temple Mount. That should not surprise anyone, because Kabbalistic Judaism teaches that man becomes God. The Antichrist will fulfill the serpent's promise to Eve that if she would only eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, an apt description of the contents of the Kabbalah, Zohar, and other mystical writings of Judaism, that she would become God. A final struggle is coming between the righteous remnant of Yahweh and the rebellious religious people of Jerusalem. This struggle will happen on two battlefronts. The Gog-Magog War is one such battle used by Yahweh to punish both houses for their rebellion by pitting them against each other inside Israel's borders. The other battle involves the two messiahs, Yeshua and the Antichrist. This battle is between kingdom and religion. Both Judaism and Christianity will be involved in this battle. Both Jews and Christians will make a choice between Yeshua and the Antichrist. Protestant Christianity wrongly teaches that the battle will be between Rome and the rest of the world as Rome rises up again to reconquer Jerusalem and all of humanity. Nowhere in the apostolic writings is Rome portrayed as the enemy of believers in Yeshua during that time. But throughout the New Testament, it is the Jews, 156 times, who are denounced for their wickedness. Rome and Romans are only mentioned 27 times, and only insofar as the Romans were a concern to or could be manipulated by Jewish leaders to kill Yeshua, both at his birth and his crucifixion, and when Paul was saying he was writing to Rome or writing from Rome. This short treatise was done to rebut the first argument religious Jews make against Christianity, which is that Judaism never expected a divine Messiah or divine king. But won't ex-Christians, you know, those new Judaism converts who denied Yeshua because of the lies taught by rabbis, be surprised when the man Jewish Messiah shows up and declares himself to be God? You need to know your why. Why do you believe Yeshua is the Messiah of Israel? Right now, many Hebrew roots and Christian believers are converting to Judaism. Most likely, this is being done to have a sense of tribal identity. However, converting to Judaism requires denying Yeshua is the Messiah and God in the flesh. The thought of doing this should scare you to death, because it is a death sentence, and one that is brought on oneself. The main job of the Jewish Messiah is to restore the Jewish nation, according to religious Jews. The reason Yeshua is not the Jewish Messiah is because he did not restore the Jewish nation. Guess what? They are right. Yeshua did not fulfill Jewish expectations of a Messiah who established Abraham's promised nation called Israel on just the house of Judah's four tribes. Yeshua will restore all 12 tribes. Of all the messiahs of the first century BC to the present, he is the only one who came saying he would restore all Israel. Matthew 15:24. But he answered, "I wasn't sent to anyone but the lost sheep of the house of Israel." This is why Yeshua is the Messiah of all Israel, and is also the reason religious Jewish leaders and anti-missionary Jews despise him. You see, the Jewish desire for Israel to be established on only four tribes, the four that are with the southern house of Judah, is nothing less than Jewish replacement theology. They make Christians feel guilty for Christian replacement theology, which says that the Christian church replaced Israel, including the Jews, but they fail to see their own replacement theology that says the house of Judah replaced all the tribes of Israel after the house of Israel was sent into exile. The issue of the Messiah is not just about which nation that Messiah will restore. Will it be one where only the house of Judah will be established as Israel? Or will it be the one who promises to gather all the tribes from the four corners of the earth to reestablish them in their territories in Israel without converting them to Judaism? Yeshua taught against the Judaism of 2,000 years ago, calling it the traditions of men. This issue of Yeshua being God in the flesh is not the real issue at all. The real issue is who gets to inherit the land. That is what the prodigal son story portrays. The prodigal son returns, but the older brother is incensed at his returns and wants nothing to do with him or his coming back into the house. The coming Antichrist will be a Jew contrary to what Protestant Christians have been taught since the Protestant Reformation of 1517 to 1648. The doctrine that the Catholic Church would produce Mystery Babylon, the Antichrist, False Prophet, the Beasts of Revelation, and the Little Horn of Daniel was created by the Reformationists Luther, Calvin, Knox, Tyndale, and Wycliffe. Yeshua never confronted the pagan doctrines of the Romans or argued with a Roman. Yeshua's only arguments came from his enemies, the Jewish leaders that sought to kill him for doing the works of his father. Yeshua told the world who would come that the Jews would accept, John 5:43, "I am come in my Father's name, and you receive me not. If another shall come in his own name, him you will receive." The Jewish man who comes in his own name will be the Antichrist. And do you know what he is? Now I'm going to reveal the Antichrist to you. This Breaking Israel News article says the sixth chapter of Genesis describes interactions between strange creatures called Nephilim, literally the fallen, and men. The article goes on to recount the history of the Nephilim after the flood. Then it says something very interesting. The Talmud in Sanhedrin 97a describes how the Nephilim will return as part of the messianic process. In the Talmud's discussion between Rav Nachman and Rav Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak asks Rabbi Nachman, "Do you know when Bar Nafli, the son of the fallen, will come?" Rav Yitzchak asks. Rav Nachman replies, "It is Messiah." Rabbi Nachman bases his answer on a verse from Amos which connects Nophelet, the fallen, with the return of the house of David. "In that day I will set up again the fallen booth of David. I will mend its breaches and set up its ruins anew. I will build it firm as in the days of old." Amos 9:11. Bar Nafli in the Talmud clearly refers to specific people who both Rav Yitzchak and Rav Nachman have heard of, and who Rav Nachman connects with the coming of the Messiah. As noted previously, the Hebrew verb nafal translates as fall, but here in the Talmud, the word is nafil in Aramaic. In the language of the Talmud, Nafli means giant. It is interesting to note that in Gematria, the words Bar Nafli, the son of the fallen, equal 372, the same as Ben Yishai, the son of Jesse, connecting the return of the Davidic dynasty with the appearance of the Bar Nafli. And I have added a coming Nephilim. Now here is additional quote from Sanhedrin 96b. Rav Nachman said to Rabbi Yitzchak, "Have you heard when the son of giants, Bar Nephli, will come?" Rabbi Yitzchak said to him, "Who is the son of giants?" Rav Nachman said to him, "He is the Messiah." Rabbi Yitzchak asked him, "Do you call the Messiah son of giants?" Rav Nachman said to him, "Yes, as it is written, 'On that day I will establish the tabernacle of David that is fallen, Hanophelet,' according to Amos 9:11. That is why the Messiah is called Bar Nephli." Rabbi Yitzhak said to him that this is what Rabbi Yohanan had said during the generation in which the Messiah, son of David, comes. Torah scholars decrease, and as for the rest of the people, their eyes fail with sorrow and grief, and troubles increase. And the harsh decrees will be introduced. Before the first passes, the second quickly comes. Take note of the troubles and the harsh decrees that are coming, being brought by the Nephilim Antichrist, part demon, part human. Forward.com's Philologos, Chris Putnam, and others have said that Amos 9:11 does not mean what the Talmud's commenting rabbis say it means. It doesn't matter whether we agree with the rabbinic comments. What matters is that Breaking Israel News has revealed that the coming Antichrist will be the offspring of a demon and a human woman, which fulfills the words of Yeshua, as in the days of Noah. And when he sits on Yahweh's throne, he will do so as an offspring of the demon that wants to destroy Yahweh's kingdom. Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Report on Beast Watch News. Full news coverage with a Hebraic perspective of the headlines fulfilling Bible prophecy. Remember to financially and prayerfully support Beast Watch News for keeping you up to date. Send your donation to Beast Watch News today. It takes money to operate this ministry, and your help is much appreciated. That's it for this Beast Watch News update. This is Kimberly Rogers Brown signing off. Click over to BeastWatchNews.com for full comprehensive coverage of all the headlines fulfilling end of days Bible prophecy.